government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
And I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time the Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced. Thousands of books have been written. And yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is, and that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The motto of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody, and welcome to Galactic Roundtable, Countdown to Disclosure. I'm very excited today because we have a special guest, and I'd like to introduce to you Stephen Bassett. He's the producer of the Citizen Hearing on Disclosure, which will be April 29th to May 3rd in Washington, D.C. An event with historical implications will be held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. from April 29th to May 3rd. At that time, as many as 40 researchers and military agency witnesses will testify for 30 hours over 5 days before former members of the United States Congress. The citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race will attempt to accomplish what the Congress has failed to do for 45 years. For this reason, the motto of the citizens' hearing on disclosure is, if the Congress will not do its job, the people will. I don't think Stephen Bassett needs any other introduction. So greetings, Steve. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a big world out there, Beth. You always need introductions. 7 billion people, I assure you, the vast, vast majority of them haven't a clue who I am.
Agreed, but my audience certainly does.
I hope so. Well, that's nice. I appreciate it.
So, Steve, I have a few questions for you.
Sure.
Here on Countdown to Disclosure, we've been featuring one witness a day. And I'd like to touch on some of the things we've been discussing here about those. When we looked at Stanton Friedman and Grant Cameron's work, both of them described for us the reasons why our government would keep a secret from the public. And I was wondering if you would comment on this fundamental question. Why would our government ever keep their engagement with extraterrestrials from us?
This is a very complicated question. It really speaks to the entire history. The last 60, essentially 6 years, that this phenomena has dominated, in a sense, the human almost psyche. I can give you the short answer, and only the short answer, but in fact, thousands of books are going to be written about the history of the truth embargo, as well as the history of the phenomena itself. And here goes. It's a matter of timing. But the timing may be connected, though that's a speculation. But at the middle of the 20th century, the population of the planet had doubled already from 1.5 million at the turn of the century to about 3 billion. And was obviously on its way, I mean, any high school kid could have run the numbers, to easily 6 billion by the end of the century. And in fact, it's now at 7.5 billion people. This is a simple truth with huge implications in terms of the pressure on the environment, on the planet, on social norms, social contracts, and so forth. Any extraterrestrial species would have known that. More importantly, in the middle of the 20th century, we held our Second World War, the biggest one to date at that time. It was a beaut. Massive destruction, massive killing, massive environmental impact. People get upset over Exxon Valdez. You know how many thousands of ships filled with oil and other fluids were sunk and sent to the ocean? And on and on. And then, of course, we dropped two atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So we are clearly at an extraordinary point in the evolution of human beings where we're now a massive threat to ourselves as a species and even all other species. A non-trivial place to be, and in the middle of that, at that time, in early 1947, extraterrestrials turned up in great numbers, and they were being seen all over the planet in the skies. If the amount of sightings that occurred then had occurred now, with all of the technology we have, and the binoculars and the cell phone cameras, everything else, Lord knows what would have taken place. But back then, a whole lot of sightings could take place, and most people would never even know that they had happened, but they were taking place. And then it culminated, of course, in the crash at Roswell, New Mexico, and possibly a second crash nearby. And so the situation was simple. As of 1947, the U.S. government and the people and the military intelligence community were faced with one: crash saucers, alien technology, dead aliens, and at least one alive alien, not knowing what all that meant, what their intentions were, what the technology's weaponry value would be, and so forth. At the same time, these same people, very sharp people, were aware that the Soviet Union was not going to be a Western ally in the post-World War II period, that there was a huge ideological split referred to by Churchill as an Iron Curtain across Europe, that they had German scientists working on their own missile technologies, that they had gotten the atomic bomb secrets and the hydrogen bomb secrets from their own spies from our programs in Los Alamos. They were threatening, well, they intended to test those bombs and start building their own nuclear arsenal, which is exactly what happened. This is what these almost all men were faced with. In 1947, they made the decision that was not a hard one to make, that until they knew more about where the Soviet threat was going, what this technology from ETs would mean, what ETs were doing here, and a lot more, they were not going to simply go to the public and say, guess what? They decided to contain it. Could they make it a secret? No. They could hold many secrets about it, but the presence of extraterrestrials was hardly a secret. They had to contain it, and this would have required highly sophisticated efforts, pretty much along the lines of the kinds of propaganda and manipulation of ideas that they were developing in order to deal with the Soviet threat. And so from that point forward, we'll take it up to 52, you had two major national security covert operations going on. One was a massive program to undermine Soviet threat, contain its expansion, and hopefully avoid a third world war that was nuclear. And alongside of that was a massive effort to contain the public's awareness of or willingness to engage the extraterrestrial issue so that they could address it in secret and covertly to understand more before they would reveal it to the public. And finally, and they couldn't have known this, good news was we did not have a nuclear Third World War, which would have been the end of pretty much anything that we care about.
Right.
And set us back hundreds of years, if not 1,000 years, as a civilization. Well, the bad news is that the Cold War lasted 44 years and got worse every year. The danger grew every year. More sophisticated and powerful weapons, more ways of housing and launching them, including huge submarines off the coast of both nations. Capable of launching on a few minutes' notice and sending missiles into cities in minutes. Well, with a total of, in the 80,000 range, the number of weapons that were among all nuclear countries by the early 80s. So there simply was no sentiment within the government that they would throw the extraterrestrial worldview paradigm change into the mix while all those weapons were poised and ready to be launched. And so the Cold War became an absolute brick wall preventing any consensus developing that would lead to a disclosure event during that period. So that's why they did it. And that's why it's called a truth embargo and not a cover-up, because it was perfectly legal, perfectly justified, and I can assure you no one's ever going to be charged with crime over that policy. Now, they broke some laws along the way. But then they've broken laws along the way in all of our covert intelligence operations, and the American people know that, and the American people give them that license. The real issue now is why hasn't the truth embargo ended in the last 22 years since the end of the Cold War?
Right.
And that's a whole nother set of explanations, which I can go into later in this conversation. But we have a fairly good understanding, I think, given the limited access to information we have the government hands, as to why 22 years after the Cold War, disclosure hasn't happened. But on the other hand, I believe it's about to happen. And so 23 years after a 44-year policy of that intensity to finally break is not that unusual, not that extraordinary. So in some respects, one can make the case we're right on schedule with respect to finally learning the truth about the extraterrestrial presence.
I would happen to have to agree with that. I guess the only comment I would make is, you know, I'm 46 years old, so in my lifetime I witnessed the Iron Curtain situation, mm-hmm. and it was a very real part of my life, but I live with three people under the age of 20. And one night at the dinner table, I said to the three of them, do you know what communism is? And they all shook their head no.
Of course. This is how the civilization advances. People with entrenched ideas and prejudices, bogus information, simply die and take all their prejudices and bogus information into another place.
That's not always a bad thing.
No. In fact, death is one of the essential qualities of evolution and to some degree even the evolution of worldviews and thinking. And the younger people who are not constrained by those views then develop their own worldview based upon the world they're in, and more things become possible. It would be nice if human beings would develop the ability to maintain much more open thinking and adaptability throughout their entire lifespan. I think this is happening. I think that you're seeing more people who are able to adapt substantially to whole new realities in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. And I think this will become much more common, but certainly not the case in the first half of the 20th century and the hardliners and the tough people that won World War II and so forth. So I am but the fact is that no one under the age, or everyone under the age of 66, has lived their entire life under and formal truth embargo imposed by their government with the cooperation of the U.S. allies, as well as the complicity, though not coordinated complicity of the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China. And that's all they've known. And therefore, the disclosure of the ET presence will in fact be the most profound worldview change, most profound event in human history, whether you're 65 or whether you're 25 or whether you're 15. But without question, the X generation hardly is supportive of the massive amount of secrecy that is still being used in government, the withholding of information of this magnitude and so forth. And so they're not going to get any support there. And one more reason why the truth embargo's days are numbered.
One more reason the truth embargo stays?
Are numbered, meaning it's near the end, is because the support for it only erodes. It doesn't grow.
It seems to me that continuing the truth embargo has an impact on every other issue in our lives.
As it turns out, it does. And getting that idea across is one of the challenges of the disclosure movement. Clearly, if you want to engage people in large-scale social activism, political activism, they need to have a reason.
Right.
They're not going to do it just to do something. If you want them to get involved in something like that, they have to have a reason that affects them. And that has been difficult because where in some political activist movements, it's very obvious what the prize is. It's very obvious what the benefit is. A perfect example would be the women's suffrage movement, where women were demanding in the early part of the 20th century that, while they had the right to vote in some limited pockets around the country, they wanted the right to vote in all elections. They wanted exact equality with respect to suffrage as men have. And they knew that if they had that vote, they could have a much better chance of developing or supporting policies and leaders that would serve the interest of women. It couldn't have been simpler. And so, yeah, there was a suffrage movement, and ultimately, of course, women got that prize and got the right to vote. Now, that's very straightforward. In the case of the ET issue, the benefits to humanity, to any single individual, are much more difficult to explain and much more intellectual. And that's one of the reasons the truth embargo has lasted as long as it has. But we're getting better and better at getting this across. And all I can say is that circa 2013, based upon what we've been able to gather with great difficulty under difficult circumstances, basically a government-imposed truth embargo, that we know a few things. So one, probably the most important thing of all is that our government has been studying and reverse engineering technology from extraterrestrial sources for 6 decades.
Mm-hmm.
Has not announced what it has learned, but there is evidence, non-trivial evidence, that the government has our government, within the military intelligence community, the covert world, has developed its own anti-gravitic propulsion, which means that they have somehow figured out and duplicated to some degree the ability of ET craft to operate anti-gravitically, a non-trivial thing.
Yeah.
And secondly, that they have developed some understanding of the energy source that these craft use to move about. And it's not any energy source that we are familiar with. There are many rumors about what it is, but it's powerful. And so whatever it is, when you couple that with the anti-gravitic propulsion technology and you have a little time to spend, it's possible to show how the emergence of those two technologies into the full public domain, where all of the intellectual resources of the human race, all 7.5 billion, would be applied with the usual precautions that, you know, not just anybody can build an anti-gravity craft or use energy technology of that power, which we're familiar with. We do this now. That those technologies could literally transform the human condition in the 21st century and solve most of the major problems we face regarding resources, pollution, and the human condition.
So maybe you're saying that if we introduced these and they would replace petroleum products and that might affect the wars around the world and that sort of thing?
You could go on and on and on. One day I'm going to hold a project and I'm going to invite everybody to submit 10 things that they think would significantly improve if we had antigravitic and a major. You could go on and on and on. It's a list that
the travel industry would change for sure.
but how that would happen, of course, remains to be seen. Everybody wants to imagine a simple switch gets pulled. No, but if in fact a technological breakthrough magnitudes greater than, say, the introduction of the internal combustion engine were to take place, allowing us to operate or generate energy, cheap electrons, I like to call them, that would allow to power our world for a fraction of the cost and a fraction of the pollution that we do now with fossil fuels. The impact on the global economies, on the human condition, is almost immeasurable.
Right.
So right there alone, if one takes a little bit of time and tries to imagine what would happen if energy costs were dropped profoundly, 85, 90, 95, 98%, and all that money was freed up to spend on other things, creating businesses, building homes, medical care, college and education, and on and on and on, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And then one imagines cities where the air is almost as good as if you were out in a national park. You start to realize, my Lord, this is another change. But it's such a massive change that for many, they simply can't get their arms around it. They can't imagine that it could even happen.
Right.
But in fact, it can't happen.
Yeah.
And if the technology is as good as we think it is, it would happen. And so that right there is one of the – is an incredibly significant reason why disclosure is essential. Why? Because it's quite clear now, 66 years since Roswell, that it is not possible for the government to allow those technologies into full public domain development without acknowledging the ET presence. They just could not finesse that card, that queen, as they say in bridge. Once that technology was emerged, there would be enormous and immediate pressure to convince the world and the press and the people that you somehow just happened to invent this all on your own. And all of that information we've been learning about ET craft is still untrue. And so the truth embargo has become not just an embargo of acknowledgement of the ET presence, but an embargo of public domain use of extraordinary new technologies. And we occasionally get glimpses of this when somebody within that field makes a statement. And a classic example of this was Ben Rich, who was the head of the Skunk Works at Lockheed.
Yeah.
I did a number of years ago. And on more than one occasion, he went out of his way to point out to whoever was listening. I mean, it's actually on film. I think you can hunt it up on YouTube.
Right.
Stating with a certain amount of, I guess you could say, arrogance and pride that you see certain technologies in play and certain types of aircraft and so forth out there. Believe me, in our secret projects, we're 50 years ahead of that.
Yes.
That's a pretty unambiguous statement, isn't it? And so if we have 7.5 billion people living in a world where every single river is polluted, where the oceans are being destroyed through garbage, when the tundra is starting to melt, when holes are turning up periodically in the ozone layer, threatening the planet in other ways, when we have projected by all of the major think tanks massive food and water shortages, which will generate wars and terrorism, when we have the breakdown of social contracts by countries under enormous financial pressure, the collapse of banking systems, and on and on and on.
Right.
This idea that the secret world can just sit there with their 50-year ahead of our time technology, you know, drink wine and party,
right,
proud of all this stuff they have that we can't have, is simply not an acceptable policy anymore. And that's another way of putting why the truth embargo must end and why there are huge benefits for people who are willing to take the time to intellectually get it.
I oftentimes tell people it's not only an intellectual issue, it's a spiritual issue. Meaning that if we're looking at all these poor countries and these wars and the mass starvation, we really have a responsibility to get this done.
Well, yeah, you know, the simple truth is that not everybody gets a degree in physics or chemistry or biology. In fact, the vast majority of people do not. They don't have strong science backgrounds. Mm. They studied other things, or they didn't go to school or college, rather. There's nothing surprising about that, nothing wrong about that. That's just the way it is. And so when something this profound turns up in your world, something that cannot be ignored, something that has to be dealt with, every person has to deal with it within the context of what they know. Mm. Their worldview, their life experience, and their knowledge base. You know, we're not going to be able to put 260 million Americans, or 300 rather, some million Americans, through a physics, you know, curriculum, develop a more, how would you say, scientific thinking on this. And the most common worldview right now, still on the planet, is a spiritual worldview, including formal religious worldview. I mean, this is the most common worldview to all peoples.
Right.
Religions change, they vary. Spirituality takes a number of forms. But amongst the 7.5 billion people, the most common thread is their spiritual religious posture. And so, not surprisingly, people by the very great numbers are trying to grasp, interpret, and understand and react with this pending transitional time from a spiritual perspective. They're looking for that in the phenomena. And in some cases, they're finding it. And so while hard rock scientists, particular secular scientists, might scoff at the idea that, well, the only way to deal with this is through hard science, and if you don't know hard science, just leave it alone and go about your business. They're not going to happen. And so we're going to see efforts to understand this phenomena in a spiritual point of view. These efforts will have value, and certainly the presence of extraterrestrials will be incorporated into people's spiritual beliefs and in religion as well. In time, we may find out what extraterrestrials believe or think about these things. And that will be quite fascinating, and I'm looking forward to that.
In my work at Galactic Roundtable, I coined a phrase. That's just my personal opinion, and I always say, Jesus drives a UFO.
Yeah.
I don't expect you to comment on that.
And there's another possibility. Jesus was an extraterrestrial.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm implying.
That's where things get really interesting. And the fact is there are a number of researchers and people who have studied religion who are increasingly looking at the history of religion, the ancient texts, the philosophies, the stories, and looking for ET possibilities. This is not a complicated or particularly sophisticated thing. Most everybody knows that almost all of the cultures of the world have stories about gods or godlike entities in their ancient past that invariably came from the sky. This is true around the world.
Right.
And extraterrestrials are pretty sophisticated, and as one pundit once said, sufficiently advanced technology as far as people will be concerned is magic. And so extraterrestrials would be viewed as gods by ancient people should shock no one. That lore would be built up around that and stories around that should shock no one. And I am perfectly prepared to learn in the post-disclosure world that a great deal of the religious lore either is a misinterpretation of extraterrestrial contact or a direct statement about extraterrestrial contact in the language of the cultures of that far distant time. Does that mean that all religious experience is ET connected? Not at all. Does that mean that there aren't things even beyond the ET realities that we're learning about that are outside of our philosophies? Absolutely. What it does mean is that a time is coming soon when the human race is going to go through a period of what we'll call reality checking, where, I mean, and it's suited to do it. I mean, we have the educational systems, we have the knowledge storage systems, we have the internet. We have the capability to reassess virtually everything we know about everything and strip away as much of the fat, as you were. I guess we'll call fat in this case, I mean simply incorrect information, and hone down our understanding of history so that it's valid as opposed to convenient, so that it's true as opposed to comforting.
Right.
And this is not without merit. The analogy I like to use is if you were to build a rocket to take people into the moon, which we have done, and you built it on hunches, speculation, lore, homilies, distant truths, the chances of that rocket getting off the ground 1 inch would be essentially zero. That a rocket going to the moon is, in a way, a massive capsule of raw truth. It must work. The principles involved must be right, sometimes right to the almost nth degree. Must all come together. There can be almost no significant mistakes, or how would you say, disconnects from reality if that rocket is to make it to the moon. And that is a world that we want to live in if we can, understanding, however, that part of the human experience and part of the joy of being human is creating fictions and myths and stories, plays and art of every kind, none of which necessarily has to be directly connected to reality or even representation of reality, but in fact are products of the human imagination. So, but unfortunately, humans have developed a problem where they are unable to distinguish oftentimes between the products of the human imagination and our art and cultures and the real realities that are necessary to function and survive in this world. These kinds of distinctions need to be clarified. I think that will be an outcome of the disclosure process. I think in the aftermath of disclosure, much more effort is going to be made to make these distinctions so that when we are dealing with reality, we're going to deal with it with gusto. And when we're dealing with the creations of the human mind, for whatever reason, and areas that are much grayer, much less clear, we'll understand that too, and we won't get them all mixed together. And I think that will be a much healthier world and a much more entertaining world as well.
I think that in the world where we've cut away the fats of the untruths, that they would be distinguished as the ones that cause suffering opposed to the creative one.
I agree. I think we have enough of a historical record to know that lying creates more damage than good. That in general, lying has short-term benefits and long-term detriments, and often the long-term detriments are tragic, catastrophic. But humans are very pragmatic. And if you need to do a lie to get something done, it's very much in the human genetic, structure to do just that. You need to get something done. You need to move forward. You need to survive. And if a lie gets you there, you get it there. As societies became more complex, though, that became much more problematic. However, there is another kind of lying that is far more dangerous. Once we developed larger populations and larger cities and structures, we developed governments that then influence the day-to-day behavior of not a few hundred or a few thousand, but hundreds of millions of people. And so when institutions of government lie, it's not like telling a white lie to your spouse,
right,
about whether or not you filled the gas tank in the car or did. It's basically you're lying to millions of people and affecting their lives, often in a very negative way. So what we have seen in the last 100 years in particular is the ascent of institutional lying. And there are very complex reasons for that, but institutional lying is now fully entrenched and doing damage on a daily basis. And the simple fact is that we can't afford the luxury of it any longer. So the truth movement that of which the disclosure process is a part of is not a movement to end little white lies by people going about their lives, or even the occasional big lie between people. That will continue on for a great many millennium, but it is designed to staunch, if not completely reverse, an extremely dangerous process of institutional lying that has become endemic worldwide,
right,
and breaking down the social contracts. That kind of lying has the potential to destroy virtually all of civilization, and we can't. We've got to prevent that.
Right. I have another burning question.
Okay, well, let's get the extinguisher out.
There have been some rumors. Some folks have said that there are established ET bases on Earth, like, for example, under lakes. Mm. Linda Moulton Howe, we were reviewing her work. She's an esteemed researcher, and she brought to us a 1986 Stan Burrish video presentation. And it featured a biochemist interaction with an extraterrestrial being kept alive in the United States in a cold hydrogen environment. And he said in the interview that this being had parts of his skin that were like sheaths that could be removed, and he could touch them to his spacecraft and interface with it, with his body. Mm-hmm. And I was wanting to ask you if there will be any more information at the citizens' hearing regarding extraterrestrials on Earth?
I think that there will be some of that. The citizen hearing on disclosure, April 29, May 3, website is citizenhearing.org, is going to be somewhat restricted. The most significant restriction is the contact phenomenon will not be included. It's just not going to be discussed. Not because it's not worth respect or important, mm-hmm. but because in the strategy of engaging the media and getting the media to start finally launching into this issue with full investigatory intentions, the contact thing is just deep and wide and very difficult to address politically and journalistically. So given the fact there's a huge amount in outside of the contact phenomenon, we're going to focus on that in the first hearing, citizen hearing on disclosure. Now, if all goes well, there will be a second hearing, hearing on contact, that could happen this year if we get the kind of support we need. If people sign up for the live stream, the broadcast of this event on the 29th of April, we created a foundation called the Citizen Hearing Foundation.
I saw that on your website.
Which we'll be linking to very soon. That is, will be a 501(c) capable of taking donations anywhere in the world from any entity or person. Right. If we get the donations we need, we'll hold another citizen hearing called Citizen Hearing on Contact. Now, within the hearing coming up, the concept of extraterrestrials amongst us is one of the most significant exopolitical questions. And it will be talked about a little bit. The evidence for it is much more complex to assess, much more difficult. The evidence for non-human craft flying around in our airspace is overwhelming. That's a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
The evidence that ETs are in those craft is pretty well established. The evidence that ETs will exit those craft is pretty well established. The evidence that ETs are operating with human beings is a little less established, but there is evidence for it. And some of that evidence comes from the contactees. And so that will probably not come up in the citizen hearing on disclosure. There have been some evidence passed on to researchers from various sources about ETs being seen in the presence of military personnel on bases.
Mm.
These could be captured ETs from crash vehicles. They could be voluntarily there. That intimates the possibility of some formal arrangements that might exist. Have these things been proven beyond a reasonable doubt? No. The evidence for much broader extraterrestrials amongst human beings is almost exclusively from contactees. Either those that have had physical contact with individuals that claim to be living amongst us, or because of humans that have had hybrid work done with them, or they've created hybrid entities, which they have then come back to see.
Right.
On craft.
Right.
Now, the logic of all this, though, is not too difficult to follow. If extraterrestrials are creating hybrids, and given that they're genetic and life science abilities are extraordinary, way past ours. The idea that they could ultimately create hybrids that could live amongst us that would carry extraterrestrial genes, maybe a substantial number of ET genes, is not illogical at all. That they might do that in order to help influence whatever process is going on is not illogical at all.
I just put out an article over the weekend about that.
So, can it be ruled out? No. Can I say with beyond a reasonable doubt that large numbers of entities with significant extraterrestrial DNA that could be actually picked up by doctors should they do sufficient examinations? No, I can't say it's been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Would I be surprised if it's true? No, I would not. Is it significant? Absolutely. The exopolitical implications are huge. Where are the hybrids?
Right.
Number of people being contacted and dealt with, voluntarily or otherwise, and the number of hybrid reports.
Right.
From the million-plus contactees that have written up accounts and sent them to researchers. every effort to sort of guess the number of contactee engagements and the potential number of hybrids always produces numbers that are rather shockingly large.
Right.
So where are they? So these are interesting questions. Do they need to be resolved in order to get disclosure? No, they do not. We do have to show or prove to anybody there are X number of hybrids or even pure ETs living amongst us to get disclosure. Is the presence of some entities a reason why people in government might be extremely reluctant to allow disclosure to happen, fearing that this other knowledge about ETs amongst us would be just too much to deal with, might create too much social unrest? Absolutely. Do we have proof that it's a direct barrier? No. And I'll close with this point. So the point I'm trying to make is we can get disclosure without it if we need to. And then we can address the hard realities of – not the hard realities, but the broader realities of just how much ET engagement has taken place and how much ET presence exists on planet. We'll be looking at, I'm sure, very intensely. And then lastly, it's worth noting that a couple years ago, an international polling company that works in conjunction with some of our well-known national polling operations like CNN or Reuters or what have you.
Right.
But Ipsos, I-P-S-O-S, Ipsos focuses on international polling. Mm. And for the first time that I'm aware of, they took the ET question to the world and attempted to get a world projection on the ET issue, meaning a representation of what the entire world thinks. They went to about 36 countries, roughly, which they felt sufficiently represented the planet, and they polled an awful lot of people. And the question that was the key to their poll was a severe one: do you believe extraterrestrials are living amongst us right now? Not do you believe that the phenomena we see in the skies and so forth is extraterrestrial?
Right.
It's a much less severe question, but are they living amongst us now?
Hmm.
20% of the world's population believe they're already living amongst us. That's approximately 1.5 billion people. The largest percentage in any country was India at 45%.
Sure.
Given the history of Indian religions and the presence of ET-type phenomena in their ancient texts, that shouldn't surprise anybody.
Right.
It's also notable that the less severe question of do you believe some of this phenomenon is extraterrestrial, which is commonly asked in national polls in the West and generally is now producing a number up in the 50% range, had that question been asked of the world's population, the number would have been much closer to 50% favorable response, with India possibly up in the 65 to 70% range.
Right.
So, again, when you see numbers like that, and this idea that, well, that's all the stupid people, get over that. That's not the case at all. In fact, the polls quite show it's just the opposite. The more intelligent, the more education, and the more income, the more likely a favorable answer. But that's, you know, the old propaganda nonsense.
Right.
This displays as well as anything this massive gap that has developed between the reality of the public's awareness and perception and government positions. And that gap is doing a lot of damage to the social contracts around the world.
Right. So, Steve, we only have a few minutes left. I just wanted to ask you one last thing. The Citizens Hearing for Disclosure Project encompasses the hearing at the National Press Club, April 29th to May 3rd, as well as a worldwide live stream and the filming of the Truth Embargo documentary. So I was hoping you would tell us more about these to wrap this up.
What's going to happen is this. On April 22nd, Stephen Greer's documentary Sirius will premiere in Los Angeles at a theater. It's already sold out, and that will start spreading around the world in various ways, however they decide to distribute that film. There's a lot of witness testimony in that film, and it raises a lot of key issues I think it's going to be impacting. 7 days later, the citizen hearing begins in Washington at the National Press Club. The goal of the citizen hearing is nothing less than ending the truth embargo this year. We would like to see one government, at minimum one government, finally break ranks this summer and come in front of their people and say, look, you're not alone in the universe. Thank you so much. We hope it's the U.S., frankly. I think that would be the best for all parties. But
that's my vote.
How are we going to do that? By creating a critical mass event, something so large, so broad, so deep, that the press will finally be on fire. It's like setting a fire in the fireplace. You put a bunch of kindling in there, but you have to light some of it. And if you don't light enough, the fire just dies out. And that's what's been happening for 60 years. We can't get the fire going. We can't get a chain reaction going. This event, the citizen hearing, will be the largest advocacy event, possibly the largest event on this issue ever held, particularly from the advocacy side. It's going to cost between $400,000 and $500,000. Mm-hmm. What we're going to do is we're going to bring in up to 40 of the top witnesses in the world to testify before former members of Congress for 30 hours, actually 40 hours with breaks over 5 days in 20 different panels. They will make 10-minute oral statements. In addition, they will submit whatever they want to into the record. And then they will take questions and answers from the members of Congress plus two experts in counsel to the members of Congress so that pretty much everything is going to come out. It will be that can come out, yet it will only represent a fraction of the total evidence that is out there supporting the ET hypothesis. To ensure that the impact is maximized, we have a top publicist working full time to get the media involved, and that's been going on for a while, and we expect significant media coverage leading into, during, and after the event. Mainstream high-level coverage. Good. And finally, to make sure that nobody misses it, we are spending a great deal of money to simultaneously translate and webcast the entire 40 hours of hearing to six languages representing one half of the world's population. Those languages are English, Mandarin Chinese, Hindi, Spanish, Arabic, and Japanese. The Mandarin will only be available in archive because it's difficult to impossible to get live stream permission into the People's Republic of China, but nevertheless will be available to the 700 million Mandarin-speaking Chinese people if they're able to access it. There will also be lectures each evening, three per evening, and all of those lectures will also be available via webcast to the English and Spanish audience only. Mm-hmm. So that gives you a sense of how big this is, how broad it is, and we hope that it will finally put the press in a position where it goes into full investigatory mode. We have been giving information to the press in volumes for decades. It's not like they don't have the knowledge. It's not like they don't know where to go. It's not like they don't have a pretty strong idea. This is the big story in history. It's not set on fire. Our job is to set their hair on fire. Running around Washington, D.C., chasing every appropriate person, demanding answers, and trying to win Pulitzer Prizes. If this happens, Argo will not survive the summer of 2013.
I want to tell everybody, I believe, if this is correct, that to live stream the entire week is only $3.80.
Yeah, we're going to charge $3.80 to watch the whole thing. And then the archives, which you'll be able to access for about a month, to sort of watch whenever you want to, will be also $3.80. So we try to make it available to anybody. We're thinking there's almost hardly anybody out there. If they own a computer, they can probably afford $3.80. And we hope people will hold parties and somebody will buy access and throw it up on their 60-inch TV and bring 20 people over, whatever. But it's there, and we're going to do everything we can to publicize the first major press release on this. The public press release goes out tomorrow morning, interestingly enough.
Great.
We'll go out to almost 200 countries, 200,000 media points. We have, you know, hooked up with a major PR firm, and
wonderful.
And we're going to be sending out multiple releases at this level all the way up to April 29. So we hope that many hundreds of millions of people will at least know about this event by April 29. We'll see. We are using all the social networking stuff, the tools and what have you, and we hope that people will share the link to the citizenhearing.org far wide, and particularly outside the U.S. It's at citizenhearing.org that people can subscribe to the webcast now and the archives now, and the players will be there. We may embed some players in some other sites, we'll see, but you'll be able to watch it at citizenhearing.org in high def or low def. It's scalable.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone that does subscribe will be supporting this advocacy work. So we hope that it will go viral. We already have some trailers out. You can watch those. Those are free at the live stream webcast once you sign up, and they're also available on the website. There'll be more trailers coming up. There'll be more videos about the witnesses coming up. This is a huge project.
Yeah.
We hope people will appreciate this effort to try to finally create the chain reaction response that this much material in one place with sufficient public coverage, or press coverage rather, could happen. And we've seen media frenzies before. We know what they're like. Once one gets started, there's no power on earth that can stop them. Not even the truth embargo can withstand a media feeding frenzy. And these frenzies could occur in any other countries. I mean, it could be in France or England. Either way, it doesn't matter. If any one of the major countries' chief of state goes in front of their people and announces the ET presence, all of the rest of the nations will probably follow within 7 days, including the United States. So it doesn't have to be here. There's any number of countries that could end this embargo. So they are also – and that's one of the reasons why we're approaching the international press en masse, and why we're broadcasting it to the world, because it isn't – the ETs are not just here for the United States. Right?
They're, yeah. Ellie said it wasn't a person-to-person call.
There's bigger purposes than just the U.S. So the U.S. is not the sole player or by any means in this, and there are other nations that I think are ready to assert themselves. We'll also be having witnesses testify from about 10 countries, so it's a fully international project.
I just want to interject that I'm really glad that you're doing the Mandarin Chinese. I've been getting unprecedented numbers of emails from China in Chinese, from Hong Kong and Taiwan. And these emails will pull on your heartstrings because they are so excited about the disclosure project, about the and the citizen hearing.
Yeah. Well, we hope that they'll have a chance to see it. We may get word the Chinese government will allow the direct stream. If they do, we'll direct stream it. There's still time. But we archive it because then the government can look at the archive, and if they're comfortable with it, they'll allow access to it. We will create a Chinese website with a separate portal in China itself. We'll do whatever's necessary. The issue is not verboten in China. It is studied by the Chinese government. They do not discourage UFO researchers at all. So mm-hmm. It's really, I think, okay, but still, they sort of have their rules, we think the live stream will not be permitted. So we don't want to create a situation where you got all these people trying to access it and they can't get it. So we're going to make it available in archive. And the other languages will go up probably within 2 days of the end of the conference on the 5th. We're going to need more time on the Mandarin Chinese archive. So while the other archives will be available through the end of May, the Chinese archive will be available through probably June 15th.
Okay. Very good.
The pay portals are up. And then the Citizen Foundation. We hope that the idea of holding more of these citizen hearings and creating a franchise in which We continue to address the issues that our government will not address and bring in the best witnesses to testify to former members of Congress. We think this is an extraordinarily powerful advocacy tool. We hope people around the world will agree and they will be able to fund more of these efforts by supporting the foundation, which will be a 501(c), and of course will allow for tax deductions.
Right. Wonderful. That's a great development. And tell us about the Truth Embargo, please, the documentary.
Again, to ensure that the impact of this event is as broad and deep as possible, we have a partnership with the LA film company that will be filming the entire citizen hearing in many different ways, and that footage will be part of, kind of at the center of, a documentary, theatrical quality. It will be available and will be finished post-production probably by fall. And we are going to do everything we can to get it into theaters. It's a shame and really a disgrace that not a single, maybe one exception back in 72, but not a single documentary on this subject has ever been given theatrical distribution in the United States or elsewhere, whereas there have been over 300 movies about fictional ETs generating over $50 billion in revenues to the industry, but not a documentary on this issue. We would like to be the first, and we're going to do everything we can to get it into theaters because that's where it should be. It gives it the gravitas and the proper exposure. And so we'll do our best, but obviously additional funding will help to ensure that possibility if we had enough funding, and we'll be doing some crowdfunding on this movie. We have the money to make the documentary, but making a documentary is one cost. The real cost is distributing the documentary.
Right.
We'll do crowdfunding, and if we generate enough from the crowdfunding sources, then we, if necessary, will distribute it ourselves.
You know how I am. I would say to you, well, how much do you need?
Oh, in terms of distributing to the theaters, a couple of million dollars will probably be necessary to be able to produce the necessary copies of the documentary for theatrical distribution. And probably that amount much money to get and ensure a deal with a studio distributor that doesn't in any way take over control of the film.
Right.
Returns to the investors. So we'll be seeking probably a couple million. But understand, we have the money to get it done. And
right.
Through other distribution means, pay-per-view and any of the other newer approaches, that we can easily do.
Right.
We believe this issue deserves to be in the theaters. You've seen documentaries in the theaters by Michael Moore and Albert Gore, and also movies about Barack Obama that are doing very well.
Right.
If these documentaries can get into 800,000-900,000 theaters, there is just no reason why a high-quality documentary about the ET issue and disclosure cannot have full theatrical distribution.
I have faith that it will.
Thank you.
Well, I think our time here is about wrapping up, Steve. I can't thank you enough for coming today to talk with us.
It's been a pleasure. Perhaps we'll do another one as we get much closer to the hearing. Happy to do so.
Would love to have you. Thank you.
I hope your audience will spread the word, share the links, use the social media to let people know this hearing is coming and to let them know about the website, citizenhearing.org. Or .net or .com. We got them all.
Well, you can be assured that my audience, and we're all standing around blowing on that fire, believe me.
Good. Thank you so much, Beth.
Thanks, Steve. Okay, everybody, thank you for joining us today on Galactic Roundtable, and please join me tomorrow. And have a wonderful day. Namaste.